Good morning, everyone, and good morning to the honorable members of the jury. I've decided this morning to deviate away from the written comments that I had initially provided and instead just try to give some testimony in terms of what is going on and how the U.S. is affecting Palestine and undermining Palestinian rights. I wanted to use my own personal experience and to share some stories of people who live in Palestine, rather than going into a long treatise about the UN and the US and their role in the undermining of Palestinian rights. Yesterday we had a very wonderful session in which we heard a lot about the UN and its abdication, the abdication of its role. We heard a lot about, in previous sessions, about the European Union and the abdication of its role. But one area where there hasn't been an abdication, in which there has been a specific undermining, is that of the United States and the role that it has played in Palestine. Now, what I wanted to do is I want to lay out for you not just what the U.S. has done, but what my submission is that the United States has deliberately attempted to change the rules of the game and to make legal what is otherwise illegal. Now, I'm not somebody who is, although I'm a lawyer, I'm not somebody who is obsessed by law. I recognize that law is derived from power. I recognize that the way that laws are made is not some organic laws, but that there is the push and power that creates laws. But that said, I think that we generally know what is just and what is unjust. And what the United States has attempted to do in Palestine is to make what is unjust seem just, what is illegal seem legal. Now, I want to first step back and pick up a little bit on what Ilan Pappe said yesterday. And Ilan said yesterday that what Israel's goal had been from 48 until the current day is to create a Jewish state in an area that was never Jewish. And the way that it was done was first through the expulsion of more than 75% of the Palestinian population in 1948, and then later through the containment of the Palestinians by viewing them either as a demographic threat or viewing them as a security threat. Now, to the members of this jury, I'm certain that they've heard this term demographic threat, and I'm certain that they've experienced this idea of being a security threat in the past. And so Israel's role and the mechanisms that it used was to try to confine Palestinians into as small spaces as possible and take as much of their land as possible. And this has been a process that has gone on since 1948 and continues on to this very day. Now, this process
also ended up taking shape in what is commonly known and referred to as the so-called peace process. In the so-called peace process,
the goal of the peace process was to simply cement that same strategy, try to take as much Palestinian land as possible and confine Palestinians into as little space as possible. This is why in 1993, when the Oslo Accords were signed, the remaining 22% of Palestine that had come under occupation in 1967 was now further subdivided into areas A, areas B, areas C, with area A, a small, tiny little portion of land, less than 18% of the 22%, the area in which the vast majority of Palestinians lived, an area in which it was now delegated to the Palestinian Authority, and we'll talk about that a little bit further. The remainder of the land, the vast majority of the land, area C, more than 60% of the land, was an area and remains an area that is under direct Israeli control. And one of the goals of the peace process, in addition to trying to remove this stain that Israel was somehow an occupier and that it was acting illegally, which it successfully managed to do, as a matter of fact, during the period of 1993 up until post-1993, 34 separate countries ended up establishing relations with Israel. They opened up trade offices in Morocco and Oman. So rather than Israel feeling the stain that it was still
and the sting that it was still an occupier and a dispossessor.
It was now suddenly being rewarded for entering into this peace process. But on the flip side, in terms of what actually happened to Palestinians and what happened to Palestinian lives, not only did the occupation continue, but it worsened and deepened. And the one thing that the peace process gave Israel cover for was this ability to continue to build and expand Israeli settlements. From the period of 1993 to the year 2000, the settler population in the West Bank doubled, went from 200,000 to roughly 400,000. Today, that settler population is now triple. We're now looking at roughly 600,000, by Israeli estimates, 600,000 Israeli settlers who are living in the occupied West Bank. Now, I say this because what I want to do is I want to contrast this with what the U.S. position has been regarding these settlements, and to show you that what the United States has attempted to do is to try to make legal what is otherwise illegal. Now, I don't think this jury really requires a long treatise and a long understanding that the idea that taking somebody's land and building settlements is illegal, or the idea that colonization is wrong. I mean, we don't really need a whole body of law and a whole treatise on this for us to understand this. But what Israel successfully did over the period of these years was not just build and expand laws, but it has now tried to change international perspectives on these settlements. If you look back to as far back as the 1967, up until the Reagan administration, the U.S. position when it came to Israeli settlements was that Israeli settlements were illegal and that they were a violation of international law. Following the peace process, and most specifically with President Clinton, that position changed to no longer being a question of illegal and a violation of international law, but now being a, quote, obstacle to peace. All right. Now fast forward to where there are now 600,000 settlers, and under the Obama administration, no longer are the settlements illegal and contrary to international law. No longer are they an obstacle to peace.
But now the U.S. position is that continued settlement activity is illegitimate.
Continued settlement activity is illegitimate. And so the question becomes, continuing since when? And what does illegitimate mean? In other words, the policy has been whittled down from being one that is illegal to now focusing on the continued settlement activity as being illegitimate, not illegal. And what this means is that in every context in which the U.S. has put its hands, and we hear this time and time again, and I'm sure there are some people in this room who will repeat this, who say, we all know what the solution looks like. We all know what a settlement looks like. I hear this time and time again. And for each person who says to me, we know what the settlement looks like, we know what the solution looks like, I ask them, really? What does it look like? What exactly is going to happen to these Israeli settlements? And in each configuration, I hear the same thing over and over again. Well, you know, we'll just redraw the borders in such a way as to accommodate these Israeli settlements. So in other words, the United States and Israel have both succeeded.
They've succeeded in making legal what is otherwise illegal. They've succeeded in making acceptable what is otherwise reprehensible through this policy of simply looking towards and trying to get Palestinians to accept these settlements. Now, it's very interesting when you look at the role that the United States has played within the UN, and we heard a great deal yesterday about the role that the UN itself has not played. And it's very interesting when you look at the number of vetoes that the United States has used over the course of the past decades. There have been, from my estimations, roughly 82 times that the United States has used the veto. Very interestingly, half of those times has been for Israel's benefit, virtually half. And when you add in the number of times that the United States has used the veto in order to support apartheid South Africa, that number becomes 70%. So in other words, the United States, in terms of its usage and trying to make legal what is otherwise illegal, it has done it both in the case
of South Africa apartheid, and in the case of Palestine. Now, I want to just very quickly talk about what life is like for those people who are now living in these areas where Israel is trying to make legal what is otherwise illegal. And specifically, I want to talk about a very small little community called Khan al-Ahmar. Khan al-Ahmar is a very tiny, tiny community on the way down from Ramallah to Jericho. It's nestled in the hills. About 150 families live there. They have no electricity. They have no water. These are families that fled in 1948 from the Nakba, the Negev, and ended up settling in this area. In 1979, Israel built a settlement and has since been expanding the settlement. It's called Kfar Adumim. Kfar Adumim is now on the hills of where Khan al-Ahmar is. If you look up from Khan al-Ahmar, you can see the lights of Kfar Adumim. You can see that they have running water. You can see that they have electricity. Now, in Khan al-Ahmar, there are a number of school children. And as is the case where people of color all over the world, the people of Khan al-Ahmar did the only thing that they knew how to do, which is resist, and struggle and resist. And so part of their resistance was that they decided that they wanted to have a school for their kids. They wanted to build a school for their kids. And they went to the Israeli authorities and they asked for a school for their kids. And the Israeli authorities came back. Now, as Ilan mentioned yesterday, the way that Israel treats the Palestinians is though they're interlopers on their own land. And they said, no, sorry, you shall not get a school because no permit will be allowed for you, and all of your structures have been built without permits, and so therefore no school.
So what did they do? They resisted. They resisted, and they resisted. And they went out and collected 2,000 used tires. They went out and they grabbed some mud, and they went and they grabbed some used old oil, and they built a school. They built a school. They built the school in 2009, and almost immediately, there was a wrath upon the school. Now, in this school and in other schools like it, we have our own Alice Walker, actually. One of the young school children in one of these schools has since won a prize for her storytelling. We have our emerging Alice Walker. But as is the case with all things that are interlopers, very quickly, the school received a demolition order. And the school is now under threat of demolition. Now, the interesting thing is the reason that it is under threat of demolition is because the illegal settlers have filed a petition inside the Israeli courts saying that this school is a threat to their peace and to their security. And the court has ruled that this school shall be demolished. And so you can see that what is illegal becomes legal. You can see this perversion of justice, that what is illegal becomes legal. And this is the way the United States has operated in terms of Palestine. Now, I can go in further and talk about the military aid and talk about the military assistance and so on, but I know that we're going to have a person who's much more distinguished and much more esteemed on this, speak on this subject. So instead, I want to look again at how the United States has aimed to make legal what is otherwise illegal. And one of the ways that they have done this is by changing the roles and flipping the roles of the occupied and the occupier. Right? Now, again, you don't need to have a legal treatise to know that people resist, that people demand their freedom, that people want to be free and will use any means necessary to achieve their freedom.
But what the United States has since done, through the provision of the Oslo Accords, was that it has flipped it on its head.
Rather than the occupier being required to provide security to the occupied, rather than the occupier being required to protect the occupied, we are now in a very perverse situation
in which the occupied, the Palestinians, are required to give protection to their oppressor,
Israel. And this is what has happened through the construction of the Palestinian Authority, through the way that the Palestinian Authority has operated, through the fact that the majority of the money that the Palestinian Authority gets is for the provision of security. In fact, more money goes towards the Palestinian Authority's Ministry of Security
than goes to education and health combined. Again, this is the idea, is that it's making legal what is otherwise illegal. It is flipping it on its head. Now, a third way in which the United States has, again, flipped these things on its head is by creating a system in which Palestinians have to negotiate for their freedom. And this has been the number one push. We keep hearing this time and time and time again, over and over by the U.S. administration and other administrations. We urge the parties to get back to the negotiating table. And the question is to get back to the negotiating table to do what? So again, the Palestinians have to negotiate their way out of their occupation. They have to negotiate their way into freedom. Again, the whole idea is that they've made legal what is otherwise illegal. They flip things on their heads. Now, I know that I'm running out of time, and I want to leave questions for... I actually want to hear more from the jury than anything else. But I want to very quickly just end with another very small anecdote. Just two nights ago, I had the pleasure of being with many distinguished members of the jury at an event in which Soher Hamad thanked the Russell Tribunal on Palestine for bringing Palestine to the United States. And I share her thanks, and I want to express my thanks.
But I also want to end with a small story. In 2005, when I was living in the Gaza Strip, I managed to go visit a woman who was the mother of a young Palestinian boy who was killed in September, end of September 2000. This young boy's name was Mohammed Durra. He was killed in front of cameras. His killing was caught live on tape, killed by the Israeli army. And 2005 was the time in which the Israelis were pulling out of the Gaza Strip. And I went to visit her. She just had a six-month-old baby. And I asked her what she was feeling now that the Israelis were supposedly pulling out of the Gaza Strip. And, of course, she was... very sad. She'd lost her son, obviously. But she had this new baby. And she turned to me and she said, "My dream for this child is that she's going to finally open up her eyes one day and look up and never see the Israelis and never see the Americans in her life." That was in 2005. My final trip down to the Gaza Strip, I've since not been allowed to go in, to the Gaza Strip, was in 2007. And I went back down to her to see her. And I asked her how her now two-year-old daughter was doing. And she said to me, "It was a dream that my child wake up, but I think it was simply a dream." And so what I want to say is that just in the same way that I'm very thankful that that the Russell Tribunal on Palestine managed to bring Palestine to the United States, it's my dream, and I know the dream of this mother, that we finally get the United States and Israel out of Palestine. Thank you.
Hey, Diana, thank you very much for that. I have a question, and it is this. Beyond the stories that you've told us, which are extremely informative, my brain keeps ticking with the why. Here we are in the United States. Why? Why is the United States involved? Mm-hmm. What does the United States gain from its interference in the policies of this foreign country? I mean, that's a general question. I mean, I might have some theories whether it satisfies some kind of strange biblical prophecy, or I don't know, but there must be a reason, and somewhere hidden from us is that reason? Why does the United States veto all these resolutions in the General Assembly of the United Nations? Do you have any thoughts yourself about why that might be?
I was going to go in this in my submission, and it'll be in my formal submission. But look, I think it's important to keep in mind that this is not a one-way street. In other words, it's not simply a question of the United States supporting Israel. But the United States is also benefiting from this whole system and from this relationship. And what I mean by that is, if you look back and if you look at what's going on now and you see the parallels in terms of what's going on in Israel and what's going on in the United States, they're quite similar. For example, the idea of the preemptive strike, which somebody talked about yesterday, the idea of a preemptive strike was first put forward by Israel. The United States has since adopted that position, that they have the right to do a preemptive strike on any country. That's one. Two is, if you look at the wall, the issue of the wall, there is a wall that the Israelis have built in the West Bank, and in the Gaza Strip, by the way, there's also a wall there. The United States is also building a wall on its border with Mexico. The issue of Guantanamo Bay and the procedures that have been used in Guantanamo Bay were largely adopted from the Israeli system. The whole procedure of administrative detainees is a procedure that has been lifted from the Israelis. The idea of drones and the drones that Imam Muhammad was talking about, this woman I was talking about, are also being used by the United States. So it's not simply a one-way street in which the United States is simply giving Israel support. The United States is also using this, and in flipping it, it's on its head, is also trying to change what's going on in this country as well. It's not just simply a one-way street. Now, there is also a number of other factors. One is, of course, the Israel lobby, which I know somebody's going to talk about today. There's also the question of the military aid and the militarization, etc. I mean, these are all issues that are involved. There is an element of Christian Zionism as well. But I think that it's you can't simply point to one issue and say it's the Israel lobby, or it's the Christian Zionist lobby, or a wide variety of things. It's a number of reasons, and one of the reasons that I think many people have overlooked is the fact that the United States also benefits from this.
Well, my question has to do with the change toward the settlements and Israel in general that occurred with the coming of Clinton to the White House. Could you talk a little about that?
Certainly. One of the changes when Clinton became president of the United States was, you know, he embarked on this peace process. And one of the things that the peace process allowed Israel to do, as I mentioned, was that it masked and allowed Israel to continue to build and expand Israeli settlements. In fact, it gave it cover to do so. So rather than countries condemning Israel, they were rushing to actually create relations with Israel. And what's interesting about President Clinton and his approach towards the settlements was that he did label the settlements an obstacle to peace, but that was it. But then they turned a complete blind eye to any settlement activity that was happening. In fact, I'll share a story, something that happened when I was working as a legal advisor to the negotiations team. I remember just before the outbreak of the second Palestinian uprising in September of 2000, the Israelis had announced that they were going to build a very large settlement just outside of Bethlehem. And the Palestinian leadership at the time complained to the Clinton administration and said, look, how can we be moving forward in this idea of peace when Israel is constantly eating up the land and taking more and more Palestinian land? And the U.S. advisor at the time, shall remain nameless, turned and said, you can't demand a settlement freeze now. There's negotiations that are taking place, and it'll all be undone in negotiations. A few short months later, the Palestinian uprising breaks out, and the same individual went to the same U.S. Official and said, you've got to stop the settlements now. You've got to do something now. If you don't, this entire process is going to be derailed. People don't have faith any longer in the peace process. And his response was, you can't demand a settlement freeze now.
Now there's violence. And so this has been the process by which the United States has operated, is that on the one hand, they label it obstacle to peace, previously illegal, now continued settlement activity is somehow illegitimate, but they do nothing to absolutely stop it. Same thing when it comes to home demolitions. There's been statements regarding the U.S. position on home demolitions, but nothing to actually stop it. These kids, and these 95 kids in this school, very soon are not going to have a school. And the U.S. position is, well, you know, it'll all be undone when you have negotiations.
There's Ronnie.
Mr. Castros.
Thanks. Diane, just further to the question posed by Roger Waters about why there's this conjunction of approach, U.S. and Israel, in terms of the wider Middle East region, and recalling the founder of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, saying that a state of the Jewish people would act as a wall against the barbarism of Asia. In today's world, U.S. interests vis-a-vis the Middle East region and the shoring up of the military state of Israel. Could you talk to that briefly? Thank you.
In terms of the U.S. position?
The position the U.S. takes in support of Israel.
Yeah,
it's wider interests.
It's actually a little bit astounding to me. I mean, if you step back and look at it and you say, well, why is the U.S., I mean, you're, back to your Roger's question, why is the U.S. supporting Israel? On every level, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. In terms of the Gulf War, the U.S. didn't benefit from its relationship with Israel. In terms of the Arab Spring, the U.S. is certainly not benefiting. In terms of the war in Iraq, the United States is certainly not benefiting. The only thing that I can say is two things. Is that one, this is the United States' version of empire and colonial rule, which other countries have gone through. And two, because power is what breeds interests. And there is a lot of there's a lot of money that goes into making sure that this alliance stays a strong one. But again, it doesn't make factual sense when you look at it objectively, and when you step back and you ask yourself, well, why is the United States supporting Israel to such an extent? Israel's not a democracy. It stands against the principles that the United States purportedly stands for, and it just simply doesn't make sense.
Angela has a question. Dennis, but Dennis is over there. Dennis, you have a question?
Is it my understanding that some form of pledge by anybody in the United States who is running for Congress, either the congressional side or the Senate side, that there is some form of pledge that they sign, and by signing it, they will receive there's some cash related to that pledge in getting that their campaign would be rewarded some way with some finances.
You mean in terms of the power of AIPAC,
the
Israel lobby, one of the groups that is involved in the Israel lobby. I don't think that there's a specific pledge. I don't know. I'm not a member of Congress. And so I don't know if there's a specific pledge that, but there is a rule by power, meaning that, you know, there have been in the past, including members here, who, when the Israel lobby, if you stand out and speak out against the Israel lobby, that there is certain times where your campaign is certainly affected in terms of money that comes to that campaign and in terms of money that goes to members of the opposite campaign. There have been a number of books that have been written about it. I'm certainly not an expert on it, but that does exist. And I don't think that we should undermine the presence of a lobby that supports Israel. I know there's been a lot of discussion about this. I'm, again, not an expert on this. But there is a lobby. There is a lobby out there. But it's not just a question of a lobby that is out there to support Israel. There's also beyond that a lobby that is out there to try to undermine rights of Americans in this country as well. And the two are intertwined.
Angela?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for your presentation and for your passion that animates and makes more urgent the knowledge you're presenting to us. I'm interested in asking you to respond to the question of how to begin to address the contradictions that are evident in the positions of those who are not afraid to challenge U.S. foreign policy in other parts of the world, yet assume that the relationship to Israel is sacrosanct. And of course, you pointed out that Israel is profoundly undemocratic, structurally undemocratic, yet it has the reputation for being the outpost of democracy in the Middle, mm-hmm. in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And particularly when it comes to issues like women's rights and LGBT rights, there's this whole pinkwashing process that persuades people somehow that this most undemocratic country is so profoundly democratic. And it seems to me that in order to place the kind of pressure on the U.S. that might lead to some changes in that policy, we have to address the point that you were making, how the U.S. benefits from this unholy alliance with Israel. And that requires us also to think about the extent to which the U.S. is profoundly undemocratic.
That's right.
So it seems as if there's a dialectic here that somehow we have to use in a way that is productive. We have to make the contradictions productive. And I was wondering if you had any ideas on how we might move in a way that would allow us to effectively put pressure on the U.S.
Well, I want to step back for just a second and look at why that's the case. I think the why is because we fundamentally want to believe that there is a system in place, and we believe in systems that are in place. And so, you know, one thing that's, I'm just going to try to relate it to some of the settlements and the way that the settlements are built and expanded. There is a body of law in Israel that surrounds the issue of the construction of Israeli settlements. Again, these are all illegal. They're all illegal, right? But because there's a system that exists, this system defines what is legal and defines what is illegal. So ironically, in the West Bank, you've got things such as legal outposts and illegal outposts, when in the superstructure, they're all illegal. But rather than us looking at the superstructure, we tend to myopically focus on the small structures and think that this is the way, if we just focus on these small structures, then it looks as though there's a system. And it does look like there's a system. I mean, there is a system in which you go and you apply for a permit. There is a system in which permits are accepted or rejected. There's a hearing process and so on and so forth, right? But in this superstructure, it's entirely illegal. And this is the way that people who support Israel have looked to Israel. They look at Israel and they say, well, it looks like a democracy. It is a democracy in this small segment, which is it's a democracy for its Jewish citizens. But it's as Hazmi Bashara once said, it's a democracy for its Jewish citizens, and it's a Jewish state for its Arab citizens. Okay? And that's the problem, is that we focus on this small structure, and in focusing on this small structure, we say, oh, well, this looks okay. But when you step back and you look at the bigger picture, obviously there's a problem. And I think that in terms of reaching out to other activists, it's that we haven't done a good enough, and I'm hoping this tribunal will do this, we haven't done a good enough job at stepping back and not just focusing on these tiny little issues, but looking at the picture as a whole. We haven't really gone through this process. There hasn't been a process in which this is articulated as an anti-colonial struggle, and that's one, or an anti-apartheid struggle. It's coming out, it's emerging, obviously, but instead it's been mostly a question of quote-unquote conflict resolution, and that's, I think, one of the major problems, is that we have to step back and start looking at this in its broader structure.
Listen, I think we're running out of time. Diana, thank you so much for your remarks. It's been great.
May I say something, please? Even though we're out of time. I think Dennis opened up a matter with which I have personal experience. And so for the purpose of making it clear that what we're talking about here is U.S. policy that is made by U.S. members of Congress, U.S. elected officials, and our president. And there is a process by which people are selected to receive resources for their political campaigns, and in the process of doing so, have an increased chance of being able to cast a vote, yes or no, on particular resolutions that arise in the Congress. And as a result of the process of sifting through candidacies, which is what the pro-Israel lobby does in this country, then there's no better situation to be had as when a particular resolution arises in Congress and you've got yes votes coming from both the Democrats and the Republicans, because you fixed the system before the people ever had a chance to select the representative. And that is the structural nature of the corrupt political system in which we operate today. And why resolutions in the Congress pass 500-2. There's a reason for this, and we cannot turn a blind eye or say it's not important. Just read the book from Paul Findlay, who lays it out. But he's not the only one. He wasn't the first one who was victimized by this process. And as long as this process is in place and the people refuse to counter-organize around and against this kind of intrusion into their voting rights, he won't be the last, or I won't be the last, because it's exactly the experience that I have had trying to represent my constituents in Georgia, and that caused people to say, what does Stone Mountain, Georgia have to do with Israel? When every vote is counted and processed in a way and monitored so that you can get 29 ovations when Benjamin Netanyahu comes to speak before the Congress, a joint session, more than even the president gets, there's a reason for that. And we shouldn't ignore it. Anyway, I think...
Cynthia, are you done? I know you're not, but it's okay. We have to move on. Thank you so much.
Get in there. Do you want to ask the next person? Good to hear you.